This ministry is supported by the members and friends of First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. If you would like to support future podcasts, go to www.ucdsm.org to make your contribution.
My interest in speaking about sexual violence and healing today was not inspired by Donald Trump. This was a topic that came to me last summer, when I was far too pregnant to be willing to preach about it. I was quite hormonal at the time. It seemed a little too vulnerable to talk about this topic. But it came up for me in response to the rape case that became part of the national narrative, the case that happened in Stanford. And you may remember it was about a 20-year-old male who was convicted of sexually assaulted a 23-year-old female who was inebriated and unconscious. And the case drew national attention for a few reasons. One was the letter the defendant's father wrote to the judge as he was considering his sentencing. And the father wrote, "His life will never be the one that he dreamed about and worked so hard to achieve. That is a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20-plus years of life." For real, he said that. Another reason it caught attention was the power of the letter that the survivor wrote and that she shared to the defendant, the convicted defendant, before the sentencing. And she spoke for many survivors in her honest portrayal of violation and its aftermath. And here's an excerpt of her description, following her description of the evidence collecting process that she went through at the hospital. When it was over, she said, "After a few hours of this, they let me shower. I stood there examining my body beneath the stream of water and decided I don't want my body anymore. I was terrified of it. I didn't know what had been in it, if it had been contaminated, who had touched it. I wanted to take my body off like a jacket and leave it at the hospital with everything else." The prosecution asked for 6 years. And despite the jury's unanimous guilty vote on all three counts, the judge sentenced him to 6 months, of which he only served three. He's currently out of jail. The judge said a prison sentence would have had a severe impact on him. I think he will not be a danger to others. And this is where I start screaming expletives. Not that I think imprisoning people will end sexual violence, but I can't believe the judge decided that that condoning message was justified in this case. And many other people rejected the judge's sentence too. The national media picked up on the case, and after 1.3 million people signed this petition asking for the recall of the judge. The petition stated, "Judge Persky failed to see the fact that Brock Turner is a white male star athlete at a prestigious university does not entitle him to leniency." The judge also failed to send the message that sexual assault is against the law, regardless of social class, race, gender, or other factors. People were outraged. So was I, and so were my colleagues. I remember it going viral on Facebook. The survivor's letter, the news about the judge, this petition. And then I saw a post among my female colleagues. We have a closed Facebook group for UU women ministers and people who identify as women. And one of the women posted this, and she gave me permission to share her reaction. She wrote, "This is a heavy question. Are there women here who've been sexually assaulted and who are experiencing a bubbling up of anger and feelings in response to the most recent Stanford rape case sentencing?" She shared her story and that basically the same thing that had happened to this survivor at Stanford had happened to her. And after she shared the details of the aftermath and how her family had responded, she said, "I don't feel comfortable sharing this publicly, but I have a strong desire to lay this burden down somewhere. I am so angry. I am so sick of this." People started pouring out the responses, "I hear you," "sending love to you." And finally, one woman responded, Me too. But it was an hour before anyone else ventured to take the risk to share the details of their own experience. And I know because I was watching and wondering if this was a safe place for me to share the details of my own experiences. I couldn't help but notice that there was this gag of sheer and of, I can't even talk, this is so hard. I'm just noticing how many times I've stumbled on words this morning. It's incredibly hard to be emotionally present in the midst of this topic. In that moment, as I watched my shame and my fear hold me back from supporting her, this courageous woman, I just sat there and watched myself. What is going on that would keep me from supporting her? I've shared my story so many times, I can't even tell you. I've told family, I've told friends, I've told partners, I've been in survivor groups, I've been to a whole weekend workshop on shame with other women where many of us were recounting the stories of our sexual violations. I even wrote about it in essays to the Ministerial Fellowship Committee when I was in the formation process of becoming a minister. So I have told this story time and time again. So what was stopping me from saying it this time? I even knew other women on the feed who had experienced sexual assault themselves. I told myself it's not a big deal. Why can't I just say it? Well, it's what's almost always stopping me when I can't just say it, and it's shame. The nature of shame as I have experienced it is that it, when it arrives, it engulfs. It says, stay low, be quiet and hide. Don't let anyone know that there's something wrong with you. Shame continues to pummel the survivor long after the assault is over. For myself, my first sexual violation happened at the age of 12. And as a child, as many of you may know, when we've experienced some kind of abuse or violation, we tend to what therapists call magical thinking, which is the only way in which we can have power as a child, is to think, well, it must be my fault. There must be something wrong with me, and that's why this happened. And so if I can change, if I can be more lovable, more kind, better at putting away the dishes, better at the bus stop, better in the classroom, in whatever case and situation it may be where we've experienced the abuse. And so for me, the experience of shame is a complex one that goes back into the roots of my identity as a person. This notion that it must have been my fault, I can do something so this won't happen to me again, and then safety can be back in my hands. Shame, pummeling us long after the act is over. And it doesn't matter if someone has broken the silence before and told their story time and time again, and it doesn't matter how much work a person has done to heal, shame will continue to show up when sexual violation is discussed. Where the survivor might increase their tools to manage and cope with it, the presence of skills does not eliminate the presence of shame. Shame comes with the territory. Many of us can barely talk about sex that we want, right? Sex that, can we even admit we find it pleasurable and that we might even dig it? It's hard for us to be sexual beings in front of one another. It's even harder then to broach the subject when it's unwanted, when it's incestuous, when it's inappropriate. It only gets easier when other people share about it too. And so after this woman posted Me Too, finally about an hour later, someone else ventured to share the details of her story, her horrifying, disgusting story. And with her courage, that second response quickly turned into 3, and then 10, and then 20, and then 50 and 90, and it couldn't be stopped. There were over 130 responses in 24 hours on one post, eventually over 200 comments. Women were sharing about their experiences. They were ministering to one another and raging at the rape culture prophetically in which we live. That day, I couldn't come into church. I couldn't look away, and I couldn't eat. My heart was simultaneously breaking as I listened to stories of women I knew and loved and respected share their hurt, at the same time as it was inspired by their courage and their resiliency. And for some, this was the first time they had ever told anyone what had happened to them. Some of them had kept their abusers' secrets for over 20, 30 years of their lives. And somehow they found the courage to share it, even though they had told no one else in their lives. They found the courage to share it on Facebook, of all places, and amongst people they're in collegial professional relationship with. And that's why I needed to preach about sexual violence and sexual healing this morning. I'm not inspired by Trump. I'm inspired by survivors. I am inspired by, in this case, it happened to be women, though I know men are survivors too. I was inspired by women being bold and courageous to form connections and heal. As each woman shared her story, we found our way from being victims into being healers of one another. Shame was no longer the most powerful force between us. I wondered what was different. I had told my story so many times. Why was this time hard, and why was it so powerful? I'd never been a part of so many people sharing their stories before. So many people who are in relationship with one another, where it's not anonymous, where we have professional reputations to worry about with one another, and yet we didn't. I could see that by sharing, we were pushing the shame back. We were pushing back the degradation. And when we were pushing it back, we were making space for us to actually stand and breathe and see one another. Space where we weren't defined by the shame of those violations, but space where we were identified with our strength. And I could see, with so many people sharing, that while the sexual violation, the particular acts, are horrifying, the shame that we often live with in its aftermath is so much more stifling and toxic. While the act ends, the backlash onto ourselves continues. It's like a fog that settles in. And when I saw the fog this morning, I thought that was eerie. But the shame is like this fog that can settle in between us, and it restricts our sight. And it hides us from knowing that there are people actually right around us that we could touch, but we don't even see them because we're isolated. And that this fog, it hides us not only from seeing the others who are right around us, standing on the same ground that we are, but it keeps us even from seeing our true selves. When I think of the story that Henry shared and the path I had to be on in my own life, like the survivor, I wanted to peel off my body. I wanted to be rid of it. I wanted to be rid of the memories. I wanted to be rid of the lack of dignity, the ownership of my own being, and the long journey to healing that I've been through to reclaim my body, to trust its wisdom, that this is my sacred home in the world, the place through which I get to know all of life. It horrifies me to think of how shame continues to damage survivors. That long after that act is over, we can feel disconnected from our primary gift of life, which is ourselves. In so many women speaking out, we were pushing that fog back. Women were shining their lights, and it changed the nature of the space between us. I could see that I was not alone, and I could see that the women around me in my calling are prophetic, that they are powerful, they are resilient, they are beautiful. There wasn't anything wrong with any of us that day. I imagine them standing up here with me now, standing here with us. This kind of healing, while we are having to suffer with the constant barrage of stories about Donald Trump's behavior and his words, we are also experiencing a backlash of women speaking out, survivors speaking out, reclaiming the space away from shame. While many women are feeling re-traumatized by what we hear in the news, and so am I, there is a writer named Kelly Oxford who refused to have her reality erased. She invited the following conversation on her Twitter feed. She posted, "Women, tweet me your first assaults. They aren't just stats. I'll go first. Old man on city bus grabs my crotch and smiles at me. I'm 12. Her first assault was the exact thing that Trump had celebrated. In her tweet, she used the same word that he used. I've chosen not to use it. But she used the word to, I think, effectively counter his claim that it's just locker room talk. It is not. It is many women's experience. The Washington Post reported that after Oxford posted this invitation stating, they stated that what followed was more than 1 million women sharing their stories. That's just 1 million women who happened to see Kelly Oxford's Twitter feed. I wasn't even on Twitter before this article. That's just 1 million people who happened to see it. Within 14 hours, they had received that many stories. She tweeted, "I'm currently receiving 2 sexual assault stories per second. Anyone denying rape culture, please look at my timeline now. Hashtag not okay. If my Twitter feed were a ticker tape at the bottom of a news network, it would look like there was a war on women." The fog keeps us from seeing the war that is happening not only on women, but on children, on men. The shame we have around our sexual beings, the shame we have around surviving violation. Oxford tweeted, "Sexual assault is a universal truth for women. No one is alone. Thank you for sharing stories of sexual assault. And to those still sharing, we don't have to carry their shame anymore." More and more people are hearing this message. Throughout the week, more women have come forward to respond to Trump's claim that it was just talk. One woman said that she was so angry watching the debate when he said, "It's just words, I never did anything," that she wanted to punch the television screen. When she finally came forward to share her story, she had held herself back. Several of the women said how they had held themselves back when it first happened, telling friends and family, but no authorities, because they thought, "What can I do to Donald Trump? There's no way I have any claim in a case like this." But after his candidacy was announced, and then specifically after he said, "No, I never did any of those things," the women came forward, and they found out they weren't alone. There were at least 6 women with these allegations before I decided I can't watch the news anymore and find out how many people he's assaulted. We don't have to carry their shame anymore. We, women and men who've survived sexual assault, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We live in a culture that collectively shames us, so let us collectively drop it. Right? Right. It was such a powerful moment for me. I wish I could share the stories that women were posting, but many women, even though we were doing it with one another, we were just pushing it back enough, but we weren't pushing it back enough that we were willing to still say in front of our congregations, "Me too, and let me tell you about it." And this is not the last time I will preach on this subject, but it is the first time I've spoken professionally about such a personal experience. And I didn't know how shame was going to show up for me. And so I purposefully posted on Tuesday sharing that I was a survivor because I did have the what I knew would be a shame backlash all day long where I couldn't think. Laura sat with me in my office and gave me a hug. I'm in a good place here amongst the staff. But that's how shame works, that pummeling backlash comes time and time again. And so will come our love and self-compassion to time and time again for me to choose to speak, to be public, to stand here, to be seen and to see, to know that it is not my identity. I came by that knowing in a difficult and kind of scary way. When I was 25, I had started to remember some of the experiences that I had encountered as a child. And one of the things I decided to do in my own healing journey was to go out into the woods on a backpacking trip by myself to come to know who I was truly. So I decided on this trip in the Adirondacks that I was going to go off the trail the first few days and set up my tent and fast. If you've ever been backpacking, you know how much time you take setting up your tent, taking it down, getting your water, getting your food, putting it back up in the tree to get away from the bears, getting it back down. I decided I'm not going to do that. I'm not taking any books. I just want to know, who is Aaron Gingrich alone in the world without all of these distractions? And I thought what I would encounter was that I would have a big meltdown and an encounter with what was wrong with me, that I would finally make the space to not be distracted and get to know, what is this that I carry around that is tormenting me, that is so horrible? That never happened. Instead, I was singing and talking to a tree, laughing at how hard it was for me to even just set my food up in the tree and get it away from me for those few days. And I realized that was, shame is a story. It was a story that was so close to the core of my identity that I couldn't even see it. It was just right in there infiltrating my whole being. But in taking that time and in being in the woods, I got to pull it out just a little bit, where I could finally see that that was not who I was. It was something I had experienced. When I finally left the woods, I called my mom and said, "I'm safe. I made it out." And she said, "Are you done proving yourself to yourself?" She was scared. And I cried, "Yeah, I think so. I hope so." I didn't know that that's what I needed, but I'm glad there was some part of me that called to find a deeper healing. And ever since that day, I have had, while I continue to struggle with the presence of shame in my life, I have a greater freedom and self-compassion and just knowing that what's at my core is love. May all survivors get to know that. On another time, I will preach about the people who have done the violations, because I want all people to know that. I want all people to be able to heal so that the cycle of violence may end. Let us close with the words from the survivor in the rape case at Stanford. She quoted Anne Lamott saying, "Lighthouses don't go running all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there shining." Although I can't save every boat, she wrote, "I hope that by speaking today, you absorbed a small amount of light, a small knowing that you can't be silenced, a small satisfaction that justice was served, a small assurance that we are getting somewhere, and a big, big knowing that you are important, unquestionably. You are untouchable. You are beautiful. You are to be valued and respected, undeniably, every minute of every day. You are powerful, and no one can take that away from you." Let us now share in a healing ritual for anyone who has been sexually violated, female or male. In a moment, I will invite you to come forward and light a candle, that we may push back the shame together, and you may be seen for your own light as we create and spread our light together. I also will invite the loved ones of survivors to come forward and light a candle, for I know too often you also are traumatized by what we have lived through and what we have to feel our way through as flashbacks arrive. And you are hurt in your own way. This is a choice. It will not hurt my feelings if none of you come up here to light a candle. As victims of sexual assault, we did not have the choice that this kind of violation came into our lives, but as survivors, we have a choice about if and when and whether we ever choose to share it and under what conditions. If you are so moved, I invite you to break the silence that may seek to protect you but creates a prison of isolation all its own. Elaine, they are lighting candles right now, that are the ones that were lit during the first service, that we may honor those people's experiences and bring their strength and light into the room with us as we practice this ritual of dropping the shame and standing in our light together. I invite you to come forward to spread your light and let us collectively drop the shame that we've been handed.